You know, when neighboring cities fight with each other for water, it's a war. When neighboring states fight with each other for a war within the same country for water, it's still a war. So I think the war is already upon us. And I think we've got to recognize the fact that one of the cliche statements I hear very often is the third world war will be fought for water. And now everybody says that, and everybody thinks they're so well informed and they're so knowledgeable about the future of this world. The problem is nobody understands that there is no third world war. Now there is just issues that have to be dealt with. There's going to be no real third world war for water. Hi, I'm Parag Agarwal and you're listening to Gut Talks, double G, U, double T.
Hi everyone, I'm Maria and welcome to Gut Talks, a podcast brought to you by Gut, WGUTT.com. I enjoy adding value and helping wherever I can, widening my spectrum of thoughts, even if it can sometimes challenge the mainstream. This is why we give data a voice and co-create a collective intelligence involving both people who are not always in the limelight and those who are, in order to learn from each other and spread knowledge, creative and critical thinking. To date, we've had guests from over 35 countries and counting. All I ask is to rate the show, leave a review and share it. It's a fantastic way to help other podcast explorers discover our content. Now let's get started. Dr. Parag Agarwal is the founder and CEO of Janajal, a social enterprise working at the intersection of technology, people and water, on a mission to bring safe water to underserved communities. This is his second appearance on the show. In this episode, we focus on water, obviously, because clean or safe water not only keeps us safe, it can also change lives, one drop at a time. How to drink safe water, where to find it, what to avoid, what to look for, the role of governments, how to stay healthy somehow. So, here we go. Thank you for this, Parag, and welcome back on Gut Talks.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, Maria. And talking to you has always been a learning curve for me because sometimes when I listen to myself, I tend to correct myself after this discussion. So thank you.
No, you're welcome. It's always weird to listen to ourselves, I guess. And I try not to think about it personally because I always listen again to myself, listening back to the episodes. And so I remember last time you came, it was on the first season of Gut Talks, and we spoke a lot about Janajal and what you're doing and the impact you're having in India, in different areas, primarily rural areas. And it goes beyond water, it goes beyond, if you want, education as well, because one of the things you said is that when people are educated on why clean water is fundamental for their well-being, you have less diseases and you have more educated people who end up building companies, because Janajal is a social enterprise supporting people in creating or making new endeavors. So this is what we left it at. And we said that at some point we have to do another episode where we explain what is clean water. So I guess let's dive into this. But before we start, can you just give an overview of what Janajal is, and I invite every listener to go back and listen to the previous episode. But what have you been up to since then?
It seems like ages, but it was only a couple of years ago. But yes, thank you for that follow-on thought discussion. And just to describe in a nutshell, I first want to highlight what the name, the word Janajal means. Jana means people in Hindi, which is India's national language, and Jal means water. So it's basically water for people. And that is precisely what we as a company aspire to do. Right from the beginning, we've aimed to make safe water available, accessible, and affordable for people on a pay-per-use basis. So the ethos pretty much was, why should safe water be expensive? Why should it be the luxury? Why should it be the privilege of only the affluent and the upper middle class and the upper class of people? Why can't the bulk of people who belong to the underserved communities or who earn as little as maybe as little as $1 per day in their lives, how can they also be covered under the ambit of safe water without having to really aspire for it? And so that's where we come from. We just completed 10 years in July.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a huge milestone. I promise you, not many people expected us to get this far because it's been a long, arduous journey. We are trying to tackle the world's biggest problem, a problem that is universally applicable to several countries whether they belong to the underdeveloped economies, developing economies, or even developed countries. I think safe water remains a problem. The form and the nature of the problems may be different, but the results are the same. So depending on where affordability lies, people are happy to just buy it and not worry about the costs. But while the bulk of the people, like I said earlier, have to worry about costs, hence do not have the option of buying it. And that's where we come in to make it available to them in a very affordable manner.
The question is, do we have to buy water?
I would say yes. And I'll tell you why. Buying water gives people the dignity of being able to afford something that they've always aspired to get. We've tried the model of making safe water available for free to people in the world through CSR support of various corporates and through other initiatives and contributions. Unfortunately, people do not feel the pride. They do not feel the dignity. They feel that they're being looked down upon. They feel that we can afford it. Why can't it be made affordable? Let's step back a couple of paces. Fundamentally, safe water is a right. Governments of this world have and must make it available to their people. But obviously there is a gap that exists in its availability. Now, the only other way that it can be made available is through private sector initiatives like ours that are actually a for-profit, but we are a social enterprise. Now, what keeps us as a social enterprise is the fact that we are working for social good and we are trying to keep that water affordable. We have the option of putting the same water in a plastic bottle, put a swanky label around it, bring in an influencer or an influential celebrity to endorse it, and sell it for 40x, going up to 100x the price. So we understand that model. It's not that we don't understand it. But the reason why we remain a social enterprise is because we come to the entire activity with a conscience, with a soul, to make safe water available. And coming back to your question, it's a great question, because everybody thinks, so here's the problem. The rich think that the poor are so poor that they cannot afford water. The poor think that the rich are so rich that they don't care. End of the day, how do we democratize society? How do we bring in a sense of equality? When the not so rich, I will not call them poor, I'll say when the not so rich and the rich are both able to afford safe drinking water by paying a price for it, that ability to pay gives them, instills the sense of pride and dignity in them. And that is what they're always aspiring for. They don't want free. They abhor free. While the governments, corporates, everybody wants to make things available for free, somebody's got to pay for it somewhere. And especially in the water sector is not like toilets, where you can build a toilet and then leave it out to defumigate in the open air or to fumigate in the open air. You've got to maintain the services. You've got to go deliver. There are operating costs. How are those costs going to also be recovered? So as long as we can kind of build a very sustainable model that does not cannibalize affordability, I think that is where the key lies. Because it's one thing to make things available for free. It's another to make it free only for 1 month and then stop delivering it to them at all. So if something has to be done on a sustainable basis over the long term, there's got to be a nominal cost associated with it. And besides, the last statement I'd like to make here is only when something has a value attached to it, does it get valued. If it's free, it starts getting misused or disregarded.
So you made some points here. I want to go back to the first one when you spoke about pride and they don't want it for free. For example, you have like the right to education, the right for like healthcare. So this is what you said. Yes, this is the ideals of governments, but there's a gap and it's not happening in a way. So my question was not just about Janal, but as you said, if it's a basic human right. The other one is, is it safe water or clean water? What's the difference?
Well, if it's clean, it's safe. So let me put it that way. It's not going to be safe if it's not clean. So largely, it is referred to as clean water. We call it safe water. And because I think what consumers are mainly concerned about is that the water must be safe to drink. They must not fall sick if they drink it. And when we say safe, it is deemed to be clean. So because cleanliness can sometimes be only optical in nature. So you may see a glass of water that is absolutely clean, but it may have microbiological contamination, which is not visible to the eye, and that may still lead to a gastro attack, or that may still lead to some kind of a diarrhea attack or some illness. So safe water is what we consider as a more relevant term here.
Okay. because I introduced you with like talking about clean water and then you were saying safe water. I'm like, okay, did I misdo it here?
No, or you were not wrong. You were not wrong. It's just that clean water also applies. So I think even the SDGs, if you look at SDG 6 and 6.1, it talks about clean water. It does not talk about safe water. So clean water is the universal term. We just kind of applied some creativity to it and graduated it to safe.
But, okay, cool. So you're talking about drinking water, but surely when we shower or wash our hands, the water needs to be safe as well. Is it at different levels? Can you just give an overview of, maybe let's put it that way, what can happen if the water is not safe to your skin, to your body, but also other kind of diseases that can be boosted by unsafe water?
It's a brilliant question. And I'm not saying this because you asked, but because not many people ask, not many people think as deep as you have to ask me this question. But let me tell you, even the water that we say is for utilities, it's bathing, showering, pot washing, hand washing, gargling, when we brush our teeth, yeah, we obviously have that water, we ingest that water. That water also needs to be safe. If that water has microbiological contamination or the hardness of that water is high, then it could lead to several issues such as hair loss. It could lead to skin diseases. It could lead to rashes. It could lead to a lot of dryness. And very often we attribute that to reasons other than water. So that is the other problem, that we never point that problem that we may have. So we may get a rash on our body, which is actually coming because of some pathogens or some microbiological contamination in the water, or the hardness of the water is causing huge amount of hair loss. And we could attribute that to our age or to the aging process, or maybe not having enough supplements in our diet. So maybe we want to go to a doctor and start dousing vitamins on a daily basis. So I'm just saying, but that water also needs to be clean. There is no substitute for safe water. Under no circumstances should unsafe water be used or consumed by a human being or by life per se. Even animals, if they consume bad water, they fall sick. So the problems are the same. It's just like I said, the form in nature is different.
What about construction? I mean, would it affect, I don't know.
So when you say construction, you mean the activity of construction of a building or of a complex? Or
it could be, the activity could be because you have humans involved, but also if it's out there. And when I say construction, let's say manufacturing as well. If for the people who are, let's say, producing or involved in the process, but also those who get the end product.
Yeah, checks and balances have to be there. I mean, there is fumes that one ingests. There is dust. There is smoke. There could be effluents. So since you spoke about manufacturing, and especially manufacturing, one of the biggest banes of the water sector is the effluents that the manufacturing processes discharge, and they do not discharge them in the correct manner. So they are basically released into stormwater drainages that further go out and contaminate water sources. And then that leads to a huge amount of domino effect in terms of negative impact on environment, on people, on the adjacent villages, on contaminating the surface water sources, and eventually leaving a lot of people adversely affected by it. So there are issues, and that's why in the Indian context, there are ISO standards that companies are expected to adhere to. I'm sure there are standards globally, but these standards have to be adopted and implemented. It cannot just be for the books and for the compliance sake, but not really implemented. So that's where the conscience of a company really comes into play, and how much they really wish to make a difference and contribute to supporting all these sustainable measures remains a question to be answered.
When you decide to go for a swim, do you go test the water before or you just go?
No, okay. Unfortunately, no, because, primarily we have an underlying trust that the pool is being managed and maintained well. Having said that, I think there are times we come out of a pool with burning eyes. And that is possibly because the chlorination in the water is a little excess. So the one thing that is always recommended is always wash yourself very well or bathe even after coming out of the pool or seawater. So, a lot of people go swim in the sea or in a river, but always come back and bathe and try and wash off whatever residues there might be on your body. Because if that is allowed to manifest, then it could lead to a larger level problem.
Okay. You mentioned that water is the world's biggest problem. Do we have to expect more wars? I know you're not a political expert, but it's more important than anything else, right? So any other resources?
It's a very heartbreaking subject. It is unfortunate that we are right now witnessing a couple of wars in the world that are active as we speak. Having said that, I think the wars are already upon us, and they've already been upon us for over a decade, maybe two decades now. You know, when neighbors fight with each other for water, it's a war. When within the condominium, there is limited amount of water and only some houses get the water and the others don't, it's still a war. You know, when neighboring cities fight with each other for water, it's a war. When neighboring states fight with each other for a war within the same country for water, it's still a war. So I think the war is already upon us. And I think we've got to recognize the fact that one of the cliche statements I hear very often is the third world war will be fought for water. And now everybody says that and everybody thinks they are so well informed and they're so knowledgeable about the future of this world. The problem is nobody understands that there is no third world war. Now there is just issues that have to be dealt with. There's going to be no real third world war for water, you know, the way they put it. So one can attribute a lot of the conflicts going on right now to water. I mean, even closer back in India, I don't want to get into details, but there are long feuds, long-standing feuds, which are actually the sole reason behind it is access to rivers and access to water. But having said all this, people need to understand that they need to make a difference. There is no point in waiting for somebody else to come up and solve the problem. If in their own little way, I mean, how much can you consume safe drinking water in a sustainable manner? Please do it. Are you privileged enough to give 1 liter of water a day to somebody in the world that is underserved or that is lacking it? Then please go out and do it. I think 8 billion people, if they start making 1 liter of water available to people in the world, that will be 8 billion liters every day. And that could possibly serve at least 2 billion people and make them self-sufficient on water. It's not such a big deal. It's just unfortunate that the capitalism and the capitalist approach by a lot of corporations has made water a very premium product. They've glorified it, added a narrative to it, and built a story around it that basically has put water on a pedestal. It's very fundamental. It need not be on a pedestal. And I think that's how the world needs to look at it. And every citizen must. It's not just a government's problem.
The question here is then why there isn't enough education around this issue?
Because there is no curriculum. If there were a curriculum, there would be education. The reason, what I mean to say is there is no cookie cutter problem statement as far as water is concerned. Everybody knows what the problem is, which is, let's say, lack of safe water. But there is no consistency on the cause of the problem. So, for example, in developing countries, pipelines are corroded. So one may argue that there are pipelines available everywhere. There's water coming out of taps. So the country is self-sufficient. But are you drinking water from that tap? Is my question to be asked. And if you're not, then those pipelines are corroded. And those pipelines are corroded and you're still receiving contaminated water. Therefore, you are resorting to packaged water. So developing nations also have a water problem. Developing nations and the underdeveloped nations sure have a problem because they lack infrastructure itself. They lack the financing sources as a government to be able to create water treatment plants, create pipeline grids. Therefore, a solution like Janajal was born. It was created. It was conceptualized simply because we decided to create a decentralized form of water treatment and then further support it with a decentralized form of water distribution so as to mitigate the need for pipelines and deliver water to people's doorstep in a safe, reliable, and sustainable manner.
Ad break? No, that's not an ad. This podcast is brought to you by GUT, GUTT, which is the platform I launched to augment human capabilities focused on creativity, design, co-creation, and critical thinking. I would love to know more about you and your preferences to continue producing this kind of content. So type in go.gut.com/talks. It takes 60 seconds to complete. That's go.gutt.com/talks. Now let's get going. You touched on a subject I wanted to jump into anyway, so let's do it now. The question is, yes, like you can go to a restaurant and they would ask you, like you go to Europe, right? If they ask you, do you want tap water or do you want bottled water? What would you go for?
What I would go for, I would always go for tap water. But I would ask them one question. Is your tap water filtered? And if they say yes, I'll take their word for it and I'll go for tap water. Because very often, bottled water is also acidic in nature. So now I'm touching upon a new problem. So even if you are consuming bottled water, it's not necessary that you are hydrating yourself. You could actually be consuming water that is actually counterproductive to the human body, because our bodies are fundamentally alkaline in nature, while a lot of the bottled waters are acidic in nature. So it tends to create another problem, which is a lot of burping and a lot of gas issues that, again, we attribute to our age or to indigestion, but we do not point it to the water that we drank.
Okay. And that would be for you in any country you go to? You would ask for tap water?
No, that may not apply to any country. That will apply mostly to the developed nations. So across Europe, maybe US, Canada, Singapore, for sure. But in a lot of other countries, I would still pick bottled water.
Okay. If I have a bottle of water here, I'm going to hide the brand. Doesn't matter. What should one look for? Like, is there anything specific to ignore, or we just need to trust the brands and just pick one?
No. So I think what you need to look at is the pH level in the water. It's very important to understand that a pH level of 7 is neutral. Anything less than 7 is acidic. More than 7 is alkaline.
Okay.
So if I may ask you, what is the pH level on the bottle?
I'm trying to find it, actually. So yeah, I see...
They put a micro print on it. So, it's not very easy to read.
So I will tell you, I'll read everything: bicarbonate 150, calcium 40.5, chloride 6.1, magnesium 10.1, nitrate 3.1, potassium 0.7, sodium 5.6, sulfate 5.3. Then you have dry resin, pH. Okay, here we go. That was kind of hidden, pH 7.8.
Okay, so pH 7.8 is alkaline water. Okay. So that should be fine. But you'll have a lot of others that may even read 4.5, maybe 6.
Okay.
So then those are the ones you should stay away from.
Okay. Can I ask you, since you live in the UAE, like here in Europe, we get water from rain, snow, whatever, right? In the UAE, it goes through a process of desalination. So they take the water from the sea, remove the salt and whatever. And what do you think about those different ways of getting water? Like, does it matter, or is just the end result? How is the process affecting the end result?
Well, I think it's a horses for courses approach. I mean, the same medicine doesn't work for all patients. And similarly, the same water treatment technology does not apply to all source waters. So every country, every region has its own dependency in terms of where they will source their water from. So I think that's perfectly okay. What is important is, what is the quality that you're actually receiving on the other side, and whether that is good enough for drinking. So I'll speak for myself. In our home, we've got our own filtration system in the house, and we only consume that water, which comes from the tap. So we run it through one level of filtration and we consume that. And we are absolutely okay with it. But I know a lot of people who buy water on a regular basis. And eventually, like I said, it's a matter of affordability. The UAE has a larger level of affordability in terms of the comfort that people have. So I think it becomes a very nominal cost in the larger scheme of things for people to just feel sure about what they're consuming. There is nobody that goes without water here. Everybody has access to water one way or the other. So here, the problem statement is not as aggravated as it would be, for example, in India, where there are still millions of people that lack access to safe water, or that lack access to even water. They've got to walk 6-8 miles every day just to fetch, carry home one urn of water on their head. So that's what then becomes a very compelling problem.
Well, this is where you guys come in, right? So you've been operating for 10 years. So you've,
Right.
But what I like about Janajal is that you're also educating the people to know what to drink and not to just drink any water.
That's an ongoing process. Yeah. How many people I know have lost weight due to drinking better water after a conversation with me? And, that's actually the magic that it does to the human body. I think people don't understand. Yeah, the lack of ignorance in terms of knowledge around water is one of the reasons why there's paucity of water and why there is a lot of illnesses in the world as well. I think if a lot of people correct the water that they drink, fundamentally, a lot of problems such as kidney failures, cancer problems, so many other illnesses, the lesser ones and the more serious ones, can be abated completely.
So even if you drink, like, as you're saying, filtered water and so on, if the water you're having is safe anyway, or would this apply like anywhere?
It applies anywhere.
Okay.
So if you drink alkaline water at all times, I think one thing that people need to remember is just drink water that has a pH level higher than 7.
Higher than 7. What's the max?
7 to 8, 8.2 should be good. I mean, more than that, also people drink 9, 9.5. But you, honestly, the incremental benefits aren't too many. But if you stay within this range of 7 to 8.5, that should be good.
You mentioned diseases. And so the only scenario I've come across is having discussions or conversations with people who have kids. And this is where they would be like, I need to buy this water for the kid or for the toddler, like the baby, the newborn, right? Actually, don't give water to newborns. So let's say,
it's a big question that new mothers have when they have babies and they need to use water to mix the milk powder in, and they're very concerned about which water they should use. Mm-hmm. So they should try not to go very high on the alcohol for the baby. So keep it around 7.5. That should be good enough. 7.5, 7.8. That should be good enough. Not more than that. Again, I'm not a qualified doctor to make these recommendations, but I'm telling you based on my experience and understanding of what I have encountered and seen. And I think these can serve as good guidelines.
Yeah, the only thing here I can think of is when it comes to babies and newborns, this is a normal discussion often shared amongst people. When it comes to adults is when there is a specific disease, for example, kidney stones, right? But other than that, it's not something doctors would most probably think about or discuss or share, right? This is what you're saying sometimes, that this should be one of the first things to look at as well, right? That's what you're trying to say, is we should not ignore.
It should be. And nobody looks at it. It's not even the last thing that people look at. I don't think even the doctors of the world even consider water to be a source of problems, of health problems to their patients. Nobody's ever drilled down to that detail. And it's like I said, the ignorance around water is what has actually amplified the problem in the world.
So, going back to why is there not enough education, and not what I mean is not just at school, but like in the media. And it's something we tend to dismiss. This is why I was a bit highlighting those points, because I think repetition is one good thing for people to always remember. So I want to make sure the listeners take away something from this.
And it is directly in their own welfare and in the welfare of their loved ones, of their families, of their friends. So I think if this is not something, and there's no rocket science, we're not telling them to go buy a very expensive device to go to make that water better. There is just some fundamental lifestyle changes and awareness that one needs to create, adopt and implement in their life.
Yeah.
And they will reap the fruit of that. It's not going to be anybody else's gain.
If we look at countries, once we were... I think it was at the end of the podcast or offline as we were discussing, and you're telling me about some contaminated, I'm paraphrasing here, rivers maybe, areas that are quite known in some parts of the world. I'm not asking you to make bad publicity or anything like that here, but maybe helping the listeners visualize a place that is so familiar can trigger something, and then they can start making links. If there is any area, part of the world, maybe even a touristic site that has water somehow that is, I wouldn't say polluted or contaminated, but where you would know that the infrastructure is not good enough.
So there are several, and let's look at it in another way. Every time there is a natural calamity that takes place in any part of the world, the first thing that gets destroyed is the water sources.
Okay.
That's the first thing that gets contaminated. And that contamination lasts for years. Haiti, after their earthquake, did not recover from their water contamination for several years. Nepal had the same problem. Every time there is an earthquake in some part of the world, every time there is some kind of a tsunami, every time there is some kind of a hurricane, water sources. I mean, Pakistan faced their worst flooding ever last year. So what was the first damage? It was to the water sources, because there is all forms of sewage. There's all forms of dirt, mud, everything that goes into that. I'm not even talking about the carcasses of animals and livestock that die and then are just left. There is nobody to take charge of their disposal. And all of this leads to long-standing issues with the water. So it's very difficult to say this water is contaminated and that water is clean, because what is clean today may turn contaminated tomorrow morning for some reason or the other. We can't foretell. But the point is, be aware. Be aware of the water sources. Be aware of the water you drink. I think that is the first step to solving a problem.
So whose responsibility is that? Is it the municipality? Is it the government? How to overturn the situation after a disaster?
I would say citizens have to take it up upon themselves eventually. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about mitigating disasters, obviously the government are responsible for basically applying course corrective measures. But I think that's never going to be enough, because there are so many people, every set of people, every community has its own unique needs, has its own unique problems. Some may even lose their homes. So for them, having a home is more priority. Some may have other issues. Some may get disconnected from the mainland because the interconnecting roads got washed out. So there are different issues. And the disaster management is a whole different subject. And it needs a high-level expertise that typically governments possess through the experts that they have to deploy those measures. But one has to think a little more micro and look inwards and simply look at what one can do to basically adopt sustainable measures in and around water. And that applies not only to themselves and their families, but also to their communities, to their surroundings.
Mm-hmm. But let's say an area is contaminated because of landfills or whatever. This will be propagated to other areas as well, right? Obviously.
That's right. Because the problem is water tables know no boundaries. You know, the same water table, the same could be running across a latitude and a longitude that can go across countries. So, for example, water tables being contaminated, it spreads.
It spreads. So how, I don't know, maybe you have a story here from Janajal. How long would it take to overturn this? Like, does it require years? Is it a natural process?
No, I think water management, and that becomes a subject of water management and not just water treatment. Water management is something I've always said requires a multi-skilled, multilateral, and a multi-pronged approach. It's like just putting a new lock on your door does not mean better security while you leave your windows open. So, you know, if you want to beef up security in your home or in your office, you've got to make it take a 360 degree approach. And then you've got to go out and apply correctives to various aspects of reinforcing your premises. Similarly, as far as water is concerned, it requires a very customized approach. No, it does not have a one shoe fits all kind of a mechanism. And that's why it is such a big challenge. That is the reason why it is not easy for a lot of stakeholders, governments, and administrative bodies to apply corrective measures, because a lot of these measures drift over the medium and the long term. And very often we know stakeholders are in office for the short term. So they may not be around for the long term. So nobody is there to really take ownership of a certain process and see it through all the way.
Do you work with water management companies yourselves at Janajal for management and treatment, or you're focusing on treatment?
No, we work with water management companies on a case-to-case, project-to-project basis. We have the ability of working with them, but we work with them in a very supportive fashion. We bring in our expertise of primarily, we possess water management expertise as well. For the longest, we have team members who've been in the water sector for 15, 20 years, even before Janajal were in the water sector. But our focus is mainly making safe water available to consumers by providing them that last mile delivery. And that is where we basically focused our attention and our operating model on, which is why we try not to look at the first mile going up to the water treatment. So we basically look at water treatment and then delivery. And how can we put that water in the hands of people, save them the effort of having to walk to the source every day, collect water and take it home.
So you've been around, just going back a little bit to Janajal, and you mentioned that water management requires a customized solution based on each challenge or issue, right? Is the Janajal model scalable? Like, can you take it to Latin America, for example, or Africa?
It's very scalable. It's very modular. It's very fungible. It is extremely scalable. Okay. So for us to take it to LATAM is not a challenge at all. We can take it to any part of the world, but the implementation strategy will have to be customized.
For sure.
So, so it's like, let's take a game of cricket as an example. The bat and ball remain the same, but depending on the situation in the game, you've got to play differently. Mm-hmm. That's the only analogy I can give here. So the tools are the same. The scientific approach we take towards devising a solution to solving the problem is the same. But we need to understand the problem and then recommend solutions to solving them.
One thing I want to add here for listeners is that what you guys do at Janajal just goes beyond just delivering the water. I'm reiterating on that because there's a lot of human-to-human involvement, education, working with communities. And this is, I guess, the part that should be kind of customized, right? Because obviously the cultures are different. People think differently, have different expectations.
You're absolutely right. You know, there is a lot of geopolitical, socio-cultural aspects that also come in when we are operating a certain project, when we are conceiving a project, when we are approaching it, when we are trying to plan it. And then once we start implementing on a daily basis, we've got to keep an eye on all these factors. Therefore, it's much more. It's the one-to-one human and the humane aspect, which is always in play. Water can never be virtual. So, you know, unless you, so.
I'll send you a TikTok sticker of water.
Yeah. So a lot of people these days send a box of sweets as a GIF file and say happy birthday. But unfortunately, you can't do that with water. It must be consumed. 65 to 70% of every human body is water.
Yes.
It is the most non-substitutable organ in our body, if I can call it one. It's a must-have. So despite all the technology that we use to drive our projects, to operate our projects, to drive efficiency, optimize the operations, we believe that technology will never lead the interventions. Technology will always support our interventions.
For sure. Yeah.
Because unless we have feet on street, and unless we are able to deal with the brick and mortar infrastructure that also needs to be harnessed to be able to make water available, the technology is of no use. Simply coming in from the top at 40,000 feet, applying a technology to something that is not there on the ground is what...
It's neither here or there. Yeah. It's humans at the end. Do you think there are enough startups, and I will say startups, not just like big corporations or NGOs, but startups, social enterprises, big corporations, like you name it, fresh, new dynamic initiatives around water? Or there is much space and room for new initiatives that are untapped or potential untapped?
Well, there is a lot of room for more companies to come into this space. So, you know, like I said earlier, 8 billion people in this world. The per capita, let's do some numbers here, just back of the envelope math. Per capita, each person consumes 8 to 10 liters of safe water for drinking and cooking.
That's only drinking and cooking.
Only drinking and cooking. I'm not talking about utilities. We're talking about 65 to 80 billion liters of safe water being required by this world every day, every morning. No single company or set of companies can by themselves do this and make it happen. It requires a larger concerted effort. But I think the larger stakeholders, you know, those who are the aid organizations, the large philanthropic organizations, the organizations such as World Bank, US-based sovereign agencies, ADB, and the likes, who are out there to support initiatives to basically make safe water available, let's say to Africa, to Mongolia, to South Asia, Bangladesh, India, they need to focus on capacity utilization. Everybody is focusing on capacity building. And capacity building is actually, I dare say, is not needed because the existing capacities that have already been built are not being utilized enough. So if they can look at utilization as much, as strongly as they look at building, so you don't need to deploy new money to build new plants. You need to deploy new money to harness the unused capacity of existing plants and create a distribution model that can deliver more water in the hands of people. That is what the world needs.
I think this needs to be saved because many can come up with some ideas here.
I'm sure. I mean, yeah. You know, we all have a laptop. How many people carry four laptops?
Yeah.
You know, we all have a phone. Do we carry four phones? Nowadays, you know, people are putting multiple SIM cards in one phone because it's not required. There is enough capacity you have on that phone to be able to put to a second, a third, and even a fourth SIM card in it. Mm-hmm. So it's all about leveraging your existing assets and harnessing their unused capacity. And that is very important. I think that shift is going to make the world a better place much faster because there's a lot of money going into cutting a new cloth, but that is not required. And this is where Channel Jewel is focusing on harnessing this spare unutilized capacity of existing water treatment plants and then creating a hub and spoke model of delivery in a completely technology enabled manner. So I don't know whether this is the best example, but we're actually Airbnb-ing water treatment plants and then we are Uberizing water by delivering it to people's doors.
And there is lots of room for
room.
For different initiatives to come. Cool. Yeah, I'm not gonna dig deeper on that one because I think I want the mind to digest that and just start coming up with ideas and see what works, right? That's if someone's interested in endeavoring in the space. And I guess they know where to find you.
Absolutely. And I stand committed that we will support them in being able to build their enterprise wherever they want to. Because in the water sector, as we see it, there is no competition. There is only collaboration. So unless we're able to look at things with that new lens of cooperating, collaborating, sharing knowledge, sharing experience and wisdom, we're going to just become self-centered. That's not what a social enterprise stands for.
Yeah. And I will add to it, on top of collaboration, co-creation as well.
Co-creation. You got it.
Just going back to the space. So the other thing I want to ask you about is actually a link I sent you a few weeks ago. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It was Mr. Beast, the famous YouTuber who built 100 wells in Kenya and who got the local authorities extremely unhappy. So, yeah, can you give a bit of background on this? Like, what does it take to build a well? Why has it been, I mean, the obvious answer is corruption, but I don't know. I didn't dig deeper, but yeah, I'd like to have your feedback on that.
Well, I mean, contentious, but yes, I'll add my two cents to it. So I don't know what Mr. Beast did, but obviously his intent was very noble. He was out there to try and build wells for people to benefit from. My assumption as to why the stakeholders possibly went after him is because he tried to highlight how bad they were to basically promote his cause and to promote his goals. And maybe that's why he got into their crosshairs and they decided to torpedo him. That's the only thing I can think of. But it's not easy to work in the water sector. That brings that point to the fore because water as a utility, water as a resource is always owned by the governments. You will not find private utilities so easily in the world. They're now creating some level of privatization, but it's not as privatized as the electricity sector is or the renewable energy sector is and so many other sectors are.
Therefore, and you have regulations, right, that can change and differ from place to another. Yeah.
So while working in the water space, I think one of the things Mr. Beast would do is dial down on his beastly nature and bring out an angel in him as well so that he's able to make friends with the other side and work with them in a more congenial manner. It needs to be more amicable. It's very tempting to show how good we are. It's very tempting to sometimes show how bad somebody else is. But that's not necessarily how one should be able to present their own value proposition. And I think that approach is what needs to be a little more calibrated. The governments of the world, we have to believe, are doing their best. Maybe it's not good enough. Maybe it's not enough.
Do we believe they're doing their best truly?
That's a very contentious question. That's a very debatable question. That question can have so many answers. So no single answer will really apply to it. And because, it has to be customized to which government we are specifically speaking about. So having said that, we've got to believe that. We've got to give them the benefit of doubt. If you ever intend to go make friends with someone, you've got to stop looking at the bad personality side of that person. So let's make it as simple as that. If you keep looking at the negative side of a person, you'll never be able to go and co-create with that person. End of the day, if you're trying to do a water-related intervention, which is under the auspices of the government by default. Mm-hmm. So going to the government is not an option. The government is an integral stakeholder in a water-related project. So what is the point in going there and riling them up and then trying to still get your work done? They will come and
cut you down. It is a tough one because government change, I mean, people in place change as well. Tough one. And maybe this is one of the reasons why many do not want to endeavor in a space where the government has to be involved heavily.
So that's one of the reasons why the water space does not have too many players. Because I'm not saying there is a government involvement, but there's always a perpetual government interface. Yeah. So they're not involved in our projects. The government is not involved in a single project of Janajal. But we have to constantly keep, you know, there's one line of communication always open with them because they are the masters and the owners of the water. Now, we cannot go out and tell the world, for example, that our water is good because the water government gives you is bad. Hence, you must take our good water. Now, that becomes a self-goal. So you've got to be, for lack of a better phrase, politically correct in being able to present yourself and act as a value-added service or act as an executioner to deliver the government's vision of making safe water available to people. You act as that enabler. Why does that cannibalize who you are? It does not cannibalize who you are. So taking a pot shot at somebody else, if that makes you look good, then you need to find other reasons to look good and other ways to look good.
Yeah, and going back to the fact anyway that you're saying the water is owned by the government, but it's actually for the people. But the government is just managing. So just going back in circle, I think it's also a matter of perspective and beliefs and in what governments do, and it changes over time. It's a tough one.
These are life skills. These are not just human skills. These are life skills.
Yes. You know. And it's really tough to generalize what governments do and don't do. They might do pretty well in one aspect or area for a specific period of time and please or deliver on the expectations of the many, but disappoint the others. So it's really tough here to even attempt at having this conversation, I would say in general. But I like your approach. And obviously you've been around for 10 years. So now you've established yourself. There is trust, I guess, to some extent. You have your connections. But for someone who's starting new, I think it might be more difficult, but it's one of the challenges of starting something new anyway. And there is room, I guess, if the government will see that you're trying to help mainly people and do something good, as long as they don't get, excuse my word, like screwed, it will be fine, right? So,
absolutely. And especially if you don't become the trigger to screw them. You don't want to be that trigger. You know, so it's very important that, and this applies to life. If you want to be friends with someone, you cannot go out and hurt that person. You cannot go out and abuse that person behind that person's back. You cannot talk ill about that person behind their back. So the rules are the same. Because they are the government, it does not mean they don't have emotions. They also get angry. So that's got to be understood.
Yeah. On the Mr. Beast part, by the way, I just read the title, but I've seen some of his videos and he just goes and does crazy videos like unthinkable things. I don't know what his real intention was here because he has a massive following base anyway. He's the biggest ever. So he can do pretty much what he wants. But for me, the title was, he said it. He said, I know they might shut them down or, you know, or he will be criticized, but he just wanted to give water. So I don't know, to be honest. But
Some people thrive in controversy. Some people bask in controversy. So it's okay. I mean, each one to their own. But if he has a long-term business plan and a business vision to really deliver 100 wells and then do 100,000 more, then he will have to change his ways. He cannot do it the way he's going about it.
Oh, yeah. He will disappoint many for sure. So is there any piece of advice that you have received, would like to give back to others?
So much advice. I get so much advice. And I'm
one that was like life-changing for you.
Yes, there's one advice I got, which I think I cherished the most. It was do less to do more.
And in what context did that help you?
I worked 24/7, 365. And there was a very senior, very highly respected gentleman who's been my advisor, who's been our advisor at Janajal, and he's a co-owner, and he is a veteran from the Indian Army. He told me one day, sat me down and told me, Parag, do less to do more. You know, you believe you're doing a lot, but, you know, perhaps your efficiencies are not up there. So start dialing down on the hours you put in, but, you know, the quality of that will go up. And I think that helped me tremendously. A lot of people still believe I do more. I could do less. But I think I'm doing a lot less than I used to earlier. But having said that, I think it's great advice. A lot of people think that multiplexing, doing many things at the same time, socializing in the evenings, having that late night, waking up in the morning, going for that jog, then coming back, then doing your emails, then going to the gym. I don't know. Everybody's built a nice 18-hour schedule that they're trying to live. And they thrive in making a statement that I sleep only for 4, 5, 6 hours. Doesn't work in the long term. You burn out and then it has its own cascading effects. So one must do less to do more.
I have a question that I probably didn't ask you before, but I've been asking this since the third season, actually. If you go back to your upbringing, travel back in time, is there anything that you felt led you to become or like an entrepreneur and wanting to focus on the cause you're actually focusing on?
I come from a very humble background. We didn't grow up in affluence. For every yes we got for something we wanted from our parents, it was preceded by 9 no's. And then the 10th one maybe was a yes out of sympathy. That, okay, we've said enough no to you, we'll get you this one. So when you grow up with paucity of resources, paucity of tools, when you grow up with limitation, obviously every parent does their best and our parents did the best for us. But then you grow up with that hunger and that fire in your stomach that at some point in time, I want to overcome this. And I want to overcome this not only in my life, but I want to overcome this in the lives of those people who are also associated with me. So, you know, for example, every morning I wake up, I say to myself that I have 150 homes to run. I don't have one home to run. I have 150 homes to run because every team member of our company and their families are an extended family of ours. So we've got to think like this. So I think all of that inculcated this empathetic quotient in the mind, this social quotient, the social aspect of wanting to do good while achieving good. Everybody wants to achieve good, but how many want to even do good and give it back? So I don't know. I hope there are a lot. I'm not saying there aren't too many, but I'm definitely one of them. I've only worked with technologies that have worked in social welfare for almost 30 years now. Things that help build a better planet, a better community, a better family, a better individual, a better state, province, whatever. I don't know. And I hope that we can do work that is sizable enough someday to be recognized as one of those change makers. The intention is not to make the change, but the intention is to be that influencer or be that motivator to others to follow the same route and go down the same route and keep adding to that effort.
You mentioned technology, and I know you're working, for example, with different technologies, but one of them is blockchain as well, right? My question to you is, since technology is quite fast, right? And you already have the structure and you would know which technology you want to plug in and use to improve your workflows. Some technologies require specific regulations and so on. So are regulations holding you back in a certain way?
No, there are no regulations holding us back. The one thing I have to say, this technology is very sexy. Technology is very glamorous. It's very alluring. You know, you want to use it and adopt more and more of it. But the one thing we're very conscious of is that we do not want to do an overkill with technology. Because if we start adopting every technology that is emerging out there or that is coming through out there, we'll eventually stop being, we'll cannibalize our affordability.
For sure. So whatever, we
only adopt those technologies that genuinely help us optimize our operations, even if it is 2.5G, even if it is 3G in the world of 5G. We don't need 4G, we don't need 5G, we won't take it on board because we don't need it. So, like I said, the ability to resist the lure of wanting to bring on all these technologies, talk about it on your deck, on your website, that desire is always there. But you've got to curb that desire if you want to stay focused on your end game, which is keep that safe drinking water affordable so that it can be scalable and so that it can be available to consumers in an equitable manner. That is the moral of the story that we are playing out the story for.
For sure, for sure. Every new improvement of up or update you would or integration you would do will require an investment, and you'd rather have more people using or drinking water. But then you do it when you need it, right? I get your point. Right? It's very hard to, when you can say, we can do this, but you're like, that's not the right time. Let's wait. It must be tough.
You know what? For you guys, you know what? If you do it down the line, by the time it becomes an outdated technology, it even comes cheaper. So you've got to be also smart about it. You know, there's no point in just going out and watching the movie on the first day, first show, because then that ticket is most expensive. You watch it on the 20th day, and the movie is the same, and you get tickets for a song.
So I'm not going to ask you about your gut feeling, because that's a question we ask, and I want to invite again everyone to listen to the previous podcast where we spoke more about Jan Aljal and what you're doing and why you're doing it and how you started it and everything. My question here is, what's the vision now? What's the future for you guys?
We want to keep at it. We want to keep doing what we're doing. We want to scale. We're trying to move into other geographies as well besides India. It's not that India doesn't offer us enough opportunity or platform or the market size, but I think it's important for us to create an impact in different parts of the world. And I think in the year 2024, we'll definitely open up at least a couple of territories outside India as well, where we will initiate or commence our operations. Having said that, we're also now thinking of other ways of taking water to people in a sustainable manner, perhaps in a packaged form, but in sustainable packaging, so that we're able to basically drive a circularity between what we call the classes model and the masses model. So Jan Ajal is the masses model, where we are trying to make safe water available to people at the bottom of the pyramid. But if we can start looking at the top and the tip of the pyramid and start serving those communities, and perhaps for every SKU that they consume, we will make X amount of water available to the masses on a pro bono basis. So the intention is to drive a circularity, like I said, and build an operating model that can eventually get more hands in the more water in the hands of people, but without compromising sustainability. So that's how we are looking at things. 2024 is going to be a very deciding year for us, a very decisive. And I'm as excited as I was in year one of Jan Ajal. So next year will be year 11. And I promise you, I'm as excited. And I feel like a 22-year-old when I think about the journey ahead.
Yeah, I know. I wanted to ask you one more question that is going back a bit to startups. I don't know if you heard of the company Liquid Death.
Yes, I have.
And they went from zero to 120 million selling canned water in 4 years. And it's the biggest non-alcoholic beverage-like company. Do you have anything to say on this one? What's your view?
No, I think they did it very smartly. Hats off to them. I think they build. They did the impossible. I think to associate death with water, which is life, was, I think, the greatest pun that there ever could have been on this planet. And for them to be able to pull it off, for them to be able to create that cult community around their product, create the loyalists. You know, I've seen their website. I love their website. The way they've branded themselves, the way they've created that entire market space is commendable. And I sincerely hope, I know as an enterprise, they're getting some huge valuations. They've been raising a lot of money. They've raised over $200 million in the last 4 years. They were last, I think, they raised at $700 million valuation. They're now going for 2x, 2.5, 4x, I don't know what. But I sincerely hope that they continue and they are able to survive. Because at some point in time, that they will begin to plateau out, is what I reckon. And that's when they will find it an uphill task of being able to keep that same growth, not only in terms of business, but revenues, volumes, so on and so forth. Maybe look beyond markets. I think Liquid Death is great for America, but I'm not sure how it's going to get accepted outside of America. Perhaps they've customized their entire narrative too strongly for America only. Perhaps. And I'll be very happy if I'm wrong. And that's maybe one of the reasons they've never gone. They're not present in any market outside of America. They only do shipping to other countries. They don't have a market physical presence. It's a lot of heavy lifting. You know, sometimes success means more heavy lifting. But they've done well. Sincere compliments to them. And I hope they do well. And they do even better.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the brand remains strong, and I like the purpose of how it all started, but I do agree with the name. Maybe that was a big thing.
It is guts, Maria. It is guts to, you know, come out with something like that. And I think the founder, being an ad man himself, I think is where he kind of conceptualized this. He found his band of boys who backed him financially in terms of their funding rounds. He's been able to deliver. But good stuff. This is what the world really needs. Stick a shock. That's what stimulates people's mind.
Thank you so much, Parag. I don't know if there's anything you would like to add, but thank you so much. And that was very, I would say, refreshing and educational. So thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you for your time, your dedication, your perseverance. It's incredible. You know, every conversation with you has been, like I said earlier, it's like a learning curve, because when I listen to myself, I identify the cheese holes in my own head. And then that helps us go back to the drawing board and work towards getting to the next better version of ourselves. But thank you for stimulating these conversations, trying to take this to people. And I sincerely hope that you keep doing what you're doing. I know you will do well. Thank you for what you're doing. I think that's the least I can say.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening. If you've derived value from the show, you can subscribe on platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Your feedback is incredibly important to us, so please consider rating the show or leaving a review. It's a fantastic way to help other podcast explorers discover our content. To gain more insights, visit our website at ggutt.com. This is wgutt.com, and see you next time.